This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Welcome to the briefing room with me, David Aronovich. Into the room full of maps, flip charts and whiteboards come people who know what they're talking about to give us the best insights possible in less than half an hour into the big matters of the moment. And you're invited too. And when you've taken us up on this invitation, you could let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. My thanks to Falco and As You Were, who've recently done so. And if you'd like, please recommend us to friends, family, workmates and the woman next to you on the bus. And if this briefing room helps you to understand what's going on in the world, you might like other editions of the podcast, which range from trade wars to the parole board and violent crime. This week, I'm getting briefed on the Home Office. Is it, in the words of one politician, not fit for purpose? Take your seat in the briefing room.
There grew up a view that the Home Office was a graveyard for politicians. It was a place you walked through at your peril, being almost certain to lose any reputation that you had.
Thus spoke Roy Jenkins, a Home Secretary who did escape with his reputation intact. But after the resignation of Amber Rudd, I want to find out what it is about the Home Office that makes it such a very difficult government department to lead. Step into the briefing room and we'll try and find out. Let's start with some deep context. One person who knows the history of the troubled department is the political documentary maker Michael Cockerell.
The Home Office was formed in 1782. It was just after the Gordon riots, where the military had shot dead 300 protesters, and they decided there was revolutions about to go on across Europe, and they decided they need a Department of Homeland Security, a Department of Law and Order. I mean, in some ways, the Home Office today is still the old Department for Law and Order, but over the years, it's grown and diminished as bits have been taken away from it and bits added to it. For a long, long time, prisons and criminal justice was part of the Home Office and caused many headaches to successive prime ministers. But that was taken away in 2007 when John Reid, who was made Home Secretary by Tony Blair after Charles Clarke had to resign.
In the wake of the problems of mass migration that we have been facing, our system is not fit for purpose.
What had happened was there had been this extraordinary debacle where the immigration department and the prisons department were not talking to each other. So a number of violent prisoners were released without the immigration department having any say on that, because they were all foreign criminals. It was a real mess. And Charles Clark, the then Home Secretary, was sort of taken apart in the Select Committee, rather like Amber Rudd was more recently. I mean, the attrition rate of Home Secretaries in the 21st century, just take that as a convenience, 18 years, 9 different Home Secretaries in one of the most complicated departments in the whole of Whitehall. So you've just read yourself in and then you're either sacked or move on or even become Prime Minister. Although that is the great exception. Theresa May, of these 18 years, stayed as Home Secretary for 6 years. One of the reasons, I think, why the Home Office causes such trouble for the Home Secretary is the extraordinary wide remit it still has, even without prisons and criminal justice. There's a whole ragbag of other things which the Home Office does, including the police, nudist beaches, mad dogs, relations with the royal family. Jack Straw said that this previous Tory Home Secretary had said to him as a warning, one of the key things you've got to remember is that any one time there'll be 50 sets of officials across the Home Office working on projects that will undermine the government and destroy your political career. And the worst thing is that not only do you not know who they are, they don't know who they are. Ken Clark said, you know, you go to bed at night thinking all's reasonably okay with the world, and then you wake up and listen to the Today programme and you discover that there's a major crisis in some part of your great department that you knew nothing about at all.
Someone has escaped from prison, there's some great police scandal, someone's broken into Buckingham Palace, somebody's been deported and has been instantly shot upon arrival at his home country. All these things, some of them serious, quite tragic cases.
A lot of Home Secretaries said the thing about the Home Office is the corridors are paved with dynamite. At any stage, something can blow up. And I remember Michael Howard saying to me, I don't pretend that in 4 years in that demanding job I made no mistakes. And it's a matter of luck, usually, whether you make your mistakes in a dark corner with nobody looking or not in the spotlight. One of the things that you spot in the Home Office is on the walls are the pictures of all the previous Home Secretaries, and there have been 95 or something like that, but there have been only 26 Sir Humphreys, the permanent secretaries. And they're called the permanent secretaries for good reason, because they are there as one after another Home Secretary can bite the dust. And often Home Secretaries have felt, whoever is Home Secretary, the department has its own policy, which will happen, whoever is Home Secretary, and that will be in the hands of the Permanent Secretary. David Blunkett, and he was Labour Home Secretary, said about some of the people working in the Home Office who would come to meetings with him, he said they were the worst, the most obstructive, miserable and disengaged, disinterested group of people I've ever come across in my life. A number of Home Secretaries still sort of feel the scars of what they feel that their Sir Humphrey, the permanent secretary, has done to them and sometimes helped end their career. Roy Jenkins, who was the youngest Home Secretary of the century, and up against him was Sir Charles Cunningham, who was the permanent secretary who'd been there for ages, and no one was allowed to communicate with the Home Secretary except through Sir Charles Cunningham, so it had to be a memo right the way up the hierarchy to Sir Charles Cunningham, and he would decide whether it would go to the Home Secretary or not. Roy Jenkins called Cunningham in, who was a much older man, and said, we're going to change this system. I want to be much more accessible to everyone in the Home Office. I'm a reforming Home Secretary. And he looked at this distinguished old civil servant and saw tears forming in his eyes and Charles Cunningham's eyes. And as Jenkins put it to me, he said, it was only sometimes afterwards I realised they were not tears of sorrow, but tears of rage.
Michael Cockerell. As recent events have shown, one area of policy that keeps catching the Home Office out in recent years, almost a paradigm of its problems, is immigration. Erica Constantine is a research fellow at Sussex University and author of a book about immigration policy under the last Labour government. What stands out for you about how that policy developed?
Broadly, my research was looking at how and why Labour expanded their immigration programme. So on the one hand, looking at whether employers were essentially driving that policy and lobbying government for more expansive Labour migration routes. Another facet was looking at the New Labour ideology itself and this move to the third way and how this modernised ideology imprinted on immigration policy in various ways.
So this was an ideology that was about openness and freedom of movement, stuff
like
that. Yes,
broadly speaking, it was really an approach that saw globalisation as both a positive thing and an inevitable movement, a sort of Tina approach, if you will, from Blair.
There is no alternative.
Exactly. And that was very much embedded within the New Labour, at least on the front bench, in terms of how they saw the issue. Whether that was consciously made or not is a different thing. It's not the case that the Labour Party sat down and said, let's increase immigration. It was more the case that this idea of the third way was imprinted, if you will, it was sort of tinkered down into various public policies in the way that they saw that issue. And a big part of that, of course, was having a liberal labour market and having a highly flexible labour market at that, hence why the Treasury was pushing it. But another major part of my research was looking at the role of government departments as well, and the idea of joined up government and how this idea of pluralising immigration to other departments outside of the Home Office, whether and how this had an influence on immigration policy. So, for example, the Highly Skilled Migrants Programme, which was established in the very early noughties, which was really the beginning of this approach, or one of the first reforms towards expanding immigration, was actually put forward by the Treasury and the Prime Minister's Initiative on International Education, which aimed to double the amount of international students in higher education, was pursued from DfE, of course. So these reforms were not meant as one cohesive strategy. It was more the case that multiple departments were pursuing expansive reforms which culminated in a broader policy to expand immigration, which was only later sort of labelled managed migration in 2005 or so.
So where did this essentially a policy of expanded migration pushed by other departments, where did that leave the Home Office?
So the Home Office is a really interesting department. It's a very tough department to work in. I think it's got one of the worst remits in terms of it has the so-called wicked issues, a remit of socially destructive issues in need of controlling. So drugs, crime, immigration. These are issues that the public demand to be controlled. And therefore, the Home Office has to react to this. They're firefighting. One of my interviewees, I loved this quote, he said that the Home Office is the business of the populist press. It's held to account in a way that no other departments are in terms of the domestic and populist pressures it faces. And as a result of that, they've had this organisational culture of being very defensive, and that is, again, tinkers down to front-level staff. So the way that the Home Office have always viewed immigration, this predates New Labour, has been to minimise it. And this is the way that they see it. This is their DNA, as one interviewee told me at the Home Office. And when we had this pluralisation in terms of government departments taking a bit of the immigration remit, what happened was that the Home Office were effectively playing catch-up. And although they were, or interviewees told me, they were quite resistant initially to this idea that immigration could, you know, dare I say it, be an economic good, the Home Office nonetheless embraced this eventually towards the mid-noughties. But they are still the department, of course, that's held to account by the public about what's going on with immigration. So in short, I think the problem with immigration, or the reason why politicians grapple with this issue so much, is because on the one hand, there are public demands to restrict it, and it's not in any party's interest to be promoting immigration, really. But on the other hand, our economy is structurally dependent on migrants, and human rights means that you can't just shut the door.
Erica Constantine, policy is one factor. But what about the internal culture of the Home Office, how it works and runs? Professor Nick Pearce has been a special advisor, a SPAD, at the Home Office as well as in other government departments. He's now director of the Institute for Policy Research at Bath University.
Well, when you first arrive in the Home Office, particularly if you've come from another government department, as I had, from education and employment, it's like walking into a sort of siege. Suddenly, everything you do is in the papers every day. The Home Secretary is being taken to court. All around you, there are forces assailing you. Every Home Secretary is completely assailed by these external forces, the press, you know, particular groups, interest groups. You've got, you know, criminal cases. You're dealing with some of the most difficult things in society, you know, people trafficking people, you know, trafficking drugs, all those sorts of things. So it's a very, very intense environment.
Now, you work closely with Home Secretaries. What would be the typical day of a modern Home Secretary?
It would start with usually the Home Secretary having spent most of the night going through their red box, sometimes having to deal with cases on the phone with officials. It would start with that day's news, listening to the Today programme, reading what's in the papers. Usually the Home Secretary will walk into the private office and there'll be a sort of queue of private secretaries and special advisers asking for...
Literally a queue.
Sometimes, yes, asking for advice on a particular issue, asking for a decision. The Home Secretary will then have, you know, meetings throughout the day. There's very rarely a gap in the diary. I mean, there's no more than sort of 5 or 10 minutes, and often that's just to go in a car to another meeting.
What did you find in the Home Office in particular with the relationships between ministers and civil servants?
It's a very fraught situation, and the relationships in the time I was in the Home Office, relationships between officials and ministers were very tense. The things that you're dealing with are very high stakes. They're in the public eye. You often need decisions very quickly. And of course, in those circumstances, mistakes get made. And when mistakes are made, obviously, then ministers don't feel they can easily trust their officials. Officials themselves also don't like being blamed by ministers. You know, they're operating a policy which has been decided by ministers. And so you very quickly get into tension and blame. And you can ride through that, but it sometimes explodes, and it has done for many Home Secretaries.
Now, were there any examples when you were at the Home Office of these sorts of things occurring?
In your day job, you would have a mix of sort of information that came up from officials giving you advice. You'd have kind of operational data. You could see, you know, the numbers of asylum seekers claiming certain things, or you could see what was happening in the prison estate and so on. You would also have a lot of people kind of from the outside coming in trying to give you information and all the rest of it. And you'd have to kind of try and balance those things up and weigh them up and weigh up when officials were correct and right and doing their best, or when they were getting things wrong and you weren't getting the full story. And you're also dealing with ministers who themselves, you know, can not always have the most, because they're under such pressure, they'll be sort of, you know, looking around saying, well, who gives me the right answer? How can I deal with this? You know, what's going on? What is the correct picture here? You know, what's going on? Go and look at those cases, sort them out, give me the right answer. So it gets very, very difficult.
And did you have examples where a minister or the Home Secretary asked a specific question which was mattered and they got the wrong answer back and then used it and then got in trouble?
You know, it would often be the case that you would be given data on, say, for example, asylum cases and the numbers of people being processed through the system for certain kinds of reasons. And then, that, you know, later on, you'd be told the figures you've been given were wrong and those have been in the public domain and you now had to rescind them. And you'd have to kind of go back to Parliament and say, you know, we got this one wrong, we got that wrong. There are also occasions when the legal advisers, who in the Home Office are quite an important group of people, because they are there to say, well, this is the law, this is what we think the judges will say, this is the case we have. And they will give you some advice about the sort of balance of probabilities that if you take a certain course of action, whether it's about crime or policing or asylum cases, and say, well, look, if you do this, this is likely to be the result of that. And sometimes that advice won't be right, and you'll end up in court and you'll get turned over. And your whole policy, and I can remember this happening on asylum cases, for example, where a certain piece of legislation had gone through, and very quickly it was challenged, taken to judicial review, and you'd lose the case. And you'd have to start from scratch. You've got to design a policy all from scratch again, and then you've got to legislate for it and take it back through Parliament and go through all of that again.
When you take a policy and you push it down, let's take as an example illegal immigration, how is that then interpreted by people lower down? I mean, what kind of discretion do they have?
When you've got things like immigration or asylum casework, there are very detailed instructions that go to the caseworkers making decisions, and they have to follow those instructions or directions when they're making decisions on cases. Their discretion is relatively constrained and limited. And that's because, for procedural reasons, you want to be fair to different applicants. You want to make sure that you're making the same decisions in the same kinds of cases. It's also because if you get it wrong and you make a decision that can't be justified, it'll get turned over on appeal. And if you start making decisions in a certain kind of way, you start effectively kind of setting a policy for certain kinds of groups. So it becomes highly bureaucratized. It can appear deeply insensitive and dehumanized. But that's because in a modern state, those sorts of decisions do get turned into bureaucratic decisions. And the caseworkers will say, and they're not highly paid people, they're doing a difficult job in difficult circumstances, they will say, well, if I don't follow the letter of these instructions, if I get this wrong, then my neck is on the line. So you have a situation where, in the normal interaction of a public servant with the people that they're there to serve, you know, you would expect human interaction, some discretion, relational sorts of insights that you would bring to bear on cases, and the space for that is squeezed out because people have to take decisions according to the rules, because if they don't, the sorts of consequences I've described can flow.
Nick Pearce. So how far are the Home Office's problems a matter of structure, of policy, or of politics? And what could be done to improve things? Joining me now in the briefing room are two people with decades of experience of Whitehall. Former senior civil servant Jill Rutter, who's now programme director at the Institute for Government, and Sue Cameron, a writer and broadcaster. Jill Rutter, if I can start with you first. What, in your perception, your experience of government, seems to be wrong with the Home Office?
Well, I think the first thing to say is the Home Office has an immensely difficult task to do. You've got rules set, policies set at the top level, but those have to be translated into individual difficult cases. And what we have is you have junior people, quite often quite inexperienced people in many cases, making what I think, you know, one minister talking to the Institute for Government said were life and death decisions. So you're asking sort of people with not that much experience making really, really difficult decisions and trying to work out, A, what the rules are. This is a sort of department where things may go to appeal, they may go to judicial review, so you need to get the rules right. But also, you've got to have your sort of antenna out there for the people who are trying to get in. So it's a, you know, you're always on the alert for being fooled, being defrauded.
So your mindset is you're looking for people who are going to lie to you, and you're looking to treat them as far as you possibly can, equally, not according to any kind of sentiment you have about them.
You're having the view that to be allowed to stay in the UK is a valuable right that people are trying to get, and many of those people who are trying to get it probably aren't entitled to do it. So that's the sort of bit of the mentality you've got. What you really want, of course, is a mentality, but it's a very difficult line to strike, that of course we're going to make it right for all the people who have a very legitimate cause to be here, but we are going to manage to find all those people who are trying to defraud us. But trying to get that right in every single individual case is quite difficult. One of the things, though, that we've seen both here and in other departments, like the Department of Work Pensions, is this tension between how much discretion do you give people to actually use common sense and how much do you actually make them go by the book. The more junior, the less experienced people you have, the more you tend to give them almost a sort of algorithm of doing that. And you've got the downward pressure of this net migration target that actually the government's policy and the very declared policy right from the top of the Home Office, right from the top of the government, is to get migration numbers down. So that's part of the context you're working in, which, if you like, leads to a bit of a presumption against. I mean, you know, not a conscious one, but a part of the background thinking is that actually, on balance, if it's a finely judged case, I will be more risk averse, and the risk averse says no rather than yes.
Sue Cameron.
Well, I agree with a lot of that. I think that one of the key things that goes wrong is that there is not enough connection between the people on the front line, the desk officers, and the policy wonks who are gathered round the Home Secretary. And one of the things that should happen, that needs to happen, is that people who really know about the front line and who know about this tension between people who they know are lying to them, and they're not all inexperienced, the desk officers, they can tell in pretty short order if somebody was a Windrush person that they have the right to be here. And they are also very much on the alert for the people who are trying to sneak in. You can't do it by numbers. You have to have good desk officers, and you have to give them discretion, but you also have to have them in the room when the policy is being decided. And they have to be able to say, for example, now listen, Home Secretary, if you want to get down, chuck out all the low-hanging fruit, anybody who hasn't got papers can't come in. If you want to say that, are you up for having horror stories all over the media about people who've lived here for 50 years being turned away when they try to get back in the country after a holiday, being threatened with deportation, because that's what it means. And that isn't the message often that gets back to Home Secretaries.
Now, you both pointed to, essentially, one of the things being the nexus between policy making and policy implementation. Other people have also pointed to this kind of third element, if you like, which is contradictory policies. So take immigration. We've heard that there was a policy of embracing globalisation, a politics of restricting immigration, and then the problem of the policy implementation. Jill, have you noticed, if you like, a kind of tension, particularly between those two first things, which is essentially we have contradictory policies we're asking the Home Office to enact?
Well, the really interesting thing is that we've actually managed to resolve that contradictory policy while we're members of the EU by supplying the labour market needs through free movement of people, while we've managed to sort of have a more restrictive approach to non-EU migration. I think it's going to be an even more acute tension going forward, because going forward you will be needing to take into account a lot of the sort of shortage areas that we previously filled from the EU and have a really direct tension. I think there's some really interesting questions about actually if you go on migration as a labour supply issue, does it rightly sit in a department whose fundamental mentality is a control mentality? And that's what people say about the Home Office. It's a department of control. You know, if you look at all the functions it has police, crime, counter-terrorism and migration. All of those are control functions, and that's what they're about.
Well, that's a very good point. Sue Cameron, just one suggestion, this is that you should split up the Home Office so that it doesn't have to do all these things.
I think they'd be balmy to do that. I think they'd be absolutely mad. Now, setting up a new department or hiving one department off and merging it with another takes at least 18 months, probably a couple of years before they settle down and work out what they're meant to be doing and gain some experience. To do that at the same time as coping with a whole set of new rules on immigration, new processes, I think the system would collapse.
Let's suppose there was no Brexit or we're beyond Brexit or whatever. Would it be desirable in principle, however, to split up the Home Office?
I think that actually we do need to look at the way we organise government after Brexit. Lots of things will change, and I think there are some really interesting questions about do we have the right machinery of government? But Sue's absolutely right. You want to take that as a long-term look at actually how do we create the institutions that we need that will last, rather than just to have a knee-jerk reaction to something's gone wrong. But I wouldn't absolve from this the sort of wider policy context. I think one of the really interesting reasons why a lot of this has happened is because the officials thought they were implementing the policy precisely as ministers wanted. A lot of these hard cases would have been coming through in letters, casework, constituency cases. That's actually the real benefit of the UK system of having ministers who are also constituency MPs, is that they get these people turning up in the surgeries and hear that things are happening. Usually that sort of flashes alarm bells. And what's quite interesting is those alarm bells weren't flashing in the Home Office. And that's for one of two reasons. Either that wasn't filtering up to the top because of inadequate connection to the front line, or they were flashing, and ministers thought, well, actually, we always thought that was going to happen. There are going to be some hard cases, and we're living with that. That's our policy.
What I'm picking up from both of you in the end is the Home Office is a Department of State with very kind of specific problems and specific history. Its real problem recently has been, essentially, we have got ourselves in the position of demanding things, demanding outcomes that we're not actually prepared to support the consequences of it, or have I got that wrong, Julie?
No, I think that's probably right, actually. I think, you know, what we've seen is a sort of tolerance for some of the outcomes. The other bit of the system that's quite interesting is, where are your safety valves? And people refer to things like, you know, the removal of legal aid, the fact that there isn't a sort of independent inspectorate of migration decisions in the way we have for sort of prisons and police, actually having a look, you know, the focus of the borders inspector is very much on the efficiency of the border rather than actually, are we getting those cases right? So where are your sort of other people, other bits of institutional machinery to make sure that you're picking up problems and dealing with them and surfacing them, making very conscious decisions?
I think there is no substitute for actually knowing what's happening on the front line and being prepared as a minister to stand up and defend it.
Well, our 28 minutes are up, and at the end of it, I think I have a picture of a incredibly and fiendishly complex department dealing with very populist issues, and where quite often the policy which it's given does not mesh with the consequences we're prepared to accept from it. And my thanks to Sue Cameron, Jill Rutter, Erica Constantine, Nick Pearce and Michael Cockerham. We'll be back in a fortnight. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Neil Koenig, Serena Tarling and Emma Bishop. And please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider, and we really do appreciate hearing from you.
Hello, it's Ray Winstone. I'm here to tell you about my podcast on BBC Radio 4, History's Toughest Heroes. I've got stories about the pioneers, the rebels, the outcasts who define tough.
And that was the first time that anybody ever ran a car up that fast with no tires on. It almost feels like your eyeballs are going to come out of your head.
Tough enough for you? Subscribe to History's Toughest Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.